So the last time I was here, my laptop died on Sunday evening. I was the first speaker on Monday. So I went to the store and I got some view graphs, and that took me the whole night to make my talk in a view graphs. And now apparently it works. Let's hope it stays working. Let's see. Yeah, well, I had more of these experiences, as Fred can remind you. The formation of black holes, you've heard a lot about black holes, and now we will talk a little bit about the formation of these things, and especially in star clusters. And one of the star clusters which is particularly interesting is this star cluster, which is the quintuplet cluster, I think. And it has a little brother, actually it's a bigger brother, which is called the Archer's cluster. You'll hear more about that. And I will show you some numerical simulations we did for these kind of star clusters and how you can make black holes and these kind of things. The simulations are done with StarLab software environment. You can download it free and enjoy yourself with this kind of nice StarLab toys. And all the calculations are done on the GRAPE 6. You have heard a lot about GRAPE 6 already, so I don't have to go into details here. I can easily skip that then. Well, we had some talks about core collapse and star clusters who go in core collapse and why they go in core collapse. Well, here you see the core radius of a star cluster in spurious n-body units, but you can translate it in your mind to parsec or so very easily. And in time, in spurious n-body units, the line you see here is the core radius as a function of time of a star cluster of 10,000 particles, equal mass, very simple, kind of the SPH type of equivalent of a fluid into a tube. The simulation you have to do in order to see if the code works, basically. You see how the system goes into core collapse at about 15 relaxation times. You can see that here. This is 15 half-mass relaxation times. And then you get these nice core oscillations we have been discussing earlier. If you don't make equal mass objects, but a few of your stars are more massive than the other objects, then your core collapse time will decrease, will go down. So instead of 15 giga year here, we made 20% of the stars twice as massive, and your core collapse time will become something like 7 initial half-mass relaxation times. Well, this is not giga years, of course, but half-mass relaxation times. So your core collapse time will go down. I put this in for Fred. This was a model with primordial binaries, and something different happens there. Now, if you really have a mass spectrum, the picture becomes a little bit more dirty. So you see here this nice post-collapse evolution of the cluster, if a number of stars is more massive. If you add a complete mass spectrum, you see here this is the line, same units, same thing, now it's in parsec instead of n-body units because we had put in stellar evolution. If you put in a mass function, you have to put in stellar evolution, basically. Time is now a million years, which you can translate it again to the same thing. And here you see the core radius as a function of time. You see here something like a core collapse very early on in the evolution of the cluster. Basically, this cluster goes immediately in core collapse due to the massive stars which sink to the center of the cluster, dominate the local cluster dynamics, and you get something like, well, is it a core collapse or not? I mean, the massive stars go into core collapse, but the rest of the cluster basically doesn't care. So the whole simulation is basically post-collapse evolution. The relaxation time of this model was 10 million years. That's about here. And you see that the core collapse time is less than about 0.2 million years, less than 2 million years. So the core collapse time really goes back dramatically to a small fraction of your relaxation time. Well, during core collapse, what happens is you get a lot of collisions between stars. And collisions between stars is not something very simple to simulate in your own body systems, but we can do that happily. And what you see here is the initial half-mass relaxation time of the star cluster on the horizontal axis, and vertically you see basically the collision rate per number of stars. We do simulations with different type of stars, different number of stars, and these are the results of many simulations. Each of these dots is more than one simulation, and the error bars are Poissonian here. And we fitted this line through it, which is a very nice fit, I think. The number of parameters here, the enormous spread in range of initial conditions, the number of particles varies between 3,000 and 64,000 stars. The mass function we changed, the initial density profiles was changed. We varied the distance to the galactic center and the orbit around the galactic center. And you see it has no influence basically on the collision rate, on how many collisions you get in this type of models. There is one thing that we think we understand pretty well, actually, now, and that is that if you go to very long relaxation times, your collision rate kind of drops. You see here, these points are below the line somewhat. And the reason is basically that if your cluster has a too long relaxation time. If your cluster have relaxation time, and the core collapse time is a small fraction of your initial half-mast relaxation time. If your relaxation time is small, the cluster will collapse relatively soon. Here indicated as TCC. And if your core collapse happens before any supernova goes off, you have the possibility that stars smash into each other and build up more massive objects, delaying the supernova itself, and therefore you can get a collision runaway type of situation. If your core collapse happens after the first star goes into a supernova, then the supernova will start dominating the local dynamics. The star which explodes is close to the core. You get a local expansion of the core, and you basically terminate your collision runaway. So you can't get a runaway if your core collapse time is larger than the first supernova. Now, supernova occurs, the most massive star goes first, generally, and that is, say, a 100 solar mass star. The turn-off age of a 100 solar mass star is about 5 million years or so. And we saw in one of the previous pictures that the core collapse time is about 1/5 of the half-mass relaxation time. So if the half-mass relaxation time is more than about 25 or 30 million years, your cluster will not make a runaway collision product, but you get individual black holes made out of the most massive stars. And these black holes do all kinds of post-collapse interesting dynamical things. They kick each other out and so. If your half-mass relaxation time is smaller than 30 million years, then you will get a stellar collision type of environment. What typically happens is that one star is favored in making collisions. The reason is very simple. Massive stars sink to the center of the star cluster. The density in the star cluster in the center is highest than anywhere else. And this guy happened to be there and have the biggest cross-section for collisions. So it is the designated target, basically, for making a collision. Once it has a collision with another star, it is more massive than anything else in the neighborhood. So it completely dominates the collision cross-section. So this one star starts at, for example, this was the result from a 12,000 particle simulation. The most massive star happened to be something like 60 solar masses. It sinks to the center of the star cluster. At about 1.5 million years, it collapses with another star. It collides. Here, this is time on this axis. This is the mass of the star. And you slowly see the mass of this superstar, or blue straggler, as you can call it, maybe. And finally, it collapses into a supernova. Well, you wouldn't recognize it as a blue straggler because there is no turn-off, really, because there are no stars have been evolving yet. So it's a kind of a blue straggler. And finally, it collapses into a supernova. You see here, very simple, we ignored stellar mass loss. But if you put in stellar mass loss, things get a little bit more complicated. But technically, the same thing stays applying. Well, the relaxation time of this cluster was 10 million years. And you see here, this is smaller than 30 million years, which we require in order to get the collision runaway. The mass increase per collision, then, total, so this line basically, is a kind of a DMDT, is a collision rate times an average mass increase per collision. You can express that very simple. You can do it theoretically, and you can see that also how it numerically works, of course. Normally, you would expect that stars of about 0.7 solar mass collides with any other star of about 0.7 solar mass. So this is the primary star, and this is the secondary star, and the primary is simply called the star which is more massive than the other star. Otherwise, you get the symmetric figure, of course. And you see here that, on average, if you just take a Salpeter type of mass function, you would expect that a 0.7 solar mass star collides with something like a 0.5 solar mass star. If you do the simulation using a dim body technique, and you overlay the figure, the results of that, you get that, first of all, you have to extend your axis to something like 100 solar mass, and you see that the most likely collision happens between something like a 20 solar mass star and something like an 8 solar mass star. So your collision mass, the mass of the collision product, the guy which collides with your runaway collision member, is much higher than the average mass in your mass function, simply because of mass segregation and the combined effect of the larger radii of the more massive stars and the larger mass of the more massive stars. David has been talking about that in more detail. And you can basically calculate your average mass increase per collision is something like a constant factor times something that depends on the mean mass in your mass function times some ratio of the relaxation time divided by the moment that collision happens. And the moment that collision happens, of course, is in there because of the turn-off mass. The turn-off is the most likely star always to collide with something else because it's the most massive star in the cluster, basically. This is okay, of course, all in the regime where you have no compact objects yet. Later you will make these kind of things. And now something goes wrong. Oh, not so wrong. All right, well, I do something very dangerous now. This was the previous thing. I'll show you how two stars smash into each other, because if two stars smash into each other, it's not really sure that they would collide. So let me go out of here. And this is the dangerous part, of course. So let me show you a little SPH calculation of the first collision which happens in one of our in-body simulations. And Jamie Lombardi was friendly enough to take these two stars, take their masses, take their radii, etc., from a stellar evolution model, and run this in his SPH code. And you can see that, well, in our in-body code, we do it very simply. We say if the stars hit at pericenter, they stick. And we're not really sure if they would propagate simply their orbit or so. But you see that it takes a few orbits before they really smash into a single kind of blob of stellar material. But and this few orbits is maybe a few years or so, several days or something like that. I mean, for the embodied simulation, it's not really of great importance if it happens the moment they hit each other or it happens a few days later. So this was our confirmation that at least the collisions in our code are, well, we're pretty happy with that. We think that is really not the biggest uncertainty. I don't know how to start. This was something like 40 and 20 or so. I can look it up exactly if you want to know. So what happens in a star system, in a star cluster? The star cluster is born with a relaxation time smaller than 30 million years. Massive stars sink to the center of the star cluster in something like a dynamical friction time scale, which is the relaxation time divided by the mass of the star you're looking at. So for a 100 solar mass star, that is 100th, give or take, of the relaxation time of your cluster. So for a star cluster with a 30 million years half mass relaxation time, somewhat on the edge of which make these things, the most massive star sink to the star cluster in about 300,000 years or so. Really goes very, very quickly. You have to do this all before the first supernova, say about 5 million years. Otherwise, supernova will go off and will start dominating your dynamics, your local dynamics. Core collapse set in at about 0.2 half mass relaxation times. Binaries are formed. I didn't discuss that really, but what of course happens, not that stars simply smash into each other, but there's a three-body encounter going on. One star escapes with some excess energy, and the two other stars remain bound, and then finally collide. So the collision occurs. There's a collision rate we measure from embody simulation. This is basically theoretical expression. This is basically measured in our models. The same star keeps colliding because it dominates the collision cross-section, and it is right where all the action is going on. It keeps colliding, therefore, with other stars. The mass increase per collision is something what is related to the average mass in the cluster and the relaxation time over the moment that the collision happens. And the final product, we don't know, but we think it happens. At some point, it will collapse into something, and let's call that a black hole. So the mass you get, the total mass you get out of this kind of scenario is typically 0.1% of the total mass of your star cluster. And it's a very solid result we see in all the simulations coming back. So a million solar mass globular cluster, a star cluster with a relaxation time smaller than 30 million years, will make a final product of about 1,000 solar mass. So far, so good. We see objects which look funny, and who knows, you have the pistol star, very nice object, which is observed, and some people think it's a 150 solar mass star. The only problem is this star, of course, it's not in a star cluster. But, you know, that's a detail. Another object is in M82, the famous observation of Karet et al. From Chandra observations. There is nothing here, or there's something here. This blob here is an X-ray source, and the blob here is gone. And that observation pointed to a 600 solar mass, well, a 600 Eddington luminosity object, an object 600 times more bright than the Eddington luminosity for a neutron star accreting at full power. And subsequent observations with the Siska instrument showed that there is a kind of a star cluster, this is source number 11, on the location of, well, they called it here an intermediate mass black hole, but maybe you should call it a very bright X-ray source or so. Whatever it is, if it is an intermediate mass black hole of, say, about 600 solar masses, and it is in the middle of a star cluster, as we see in the infrared image, then this may be a kind of a candidate for this type of scenario, which happens. Who knows? Yeah, well, I mean, the arrow bars of these observations, you should get it to how secure that is. But it is, of course, an arrow circle and another arrow circle on each other. It's consistent with being in the same spot. Well, the next thing I want to go to is not isolated star clusters. This may happen in isolated star clusters. This can also happen in star clusters very near the galactic center. And the galactic center is particularly interesting because there are quite a few very compact star clusters. Well, why are these star clusters so compact near the galactic center? Because there is no room for bigger star clusters. So this is an image of the galactic center in the radio. You see here is the Arches type of filament. The star cluster, the Arches cluster, was observed in space telescopes. Looks very nice, very compact star cluster. About 50,000 stars or so. And the radius of the cluster itself, the half-mass radius, is about 0.2 parsec. So the relaxation time of this cluster is less than 30 million years. So this is an exactly very nice candidate for making a runaway collision and finally producing an intermediate mass black hole. There's the exception that this cluster is only 3 million years old. So it's too young still to have an object like that in its core. It's doing it. It's in the act of doing it. How an observer would see kind of a runaway collision, I'm not really sure. But that's I mean, these things get difficult. In the middle of the galactic center, you have a source which is called IRS-16. It's a lot of X-ray point sources, which was actually yesterday on the ASTRO-PH. Very nice paper. We see all these X-ray point sources here. And the IRS-16 sources are among these point sources. They're very massive, very bright young stars. And they have been formed somewhere. And the idea is that a star cluster was formed at some distance from the galactic center. Due to dynamical friction, the star cluster spirals into the galactic center, deposits its massive stars in the galactic center. And the massive stars are deposited there because they sink to the center of the cluster by mass segregation, and they make, at the same time, an intermediate mass black hole. And then you can explain the IRS-16 sources as being deposited there from a star cluster which brings these guys in. Well, how does that work? We did some model calculations for that. You take a star cluster, you put it at the distance of, for example, 4 parsecs from the galactic center. Why at 4 parsecs? It's, of course, very, very, very close by. And the Archer's cluster is at the distance of about 30 parsecs from the galactic center. Well, the Archer's cluster will not make it into the galactic center because dynamical friction is not that efficient. Our clusters are limited to about 60,000 stars or so due to numerical reasons. And therefore, we start in a little bit closer just to study if the effect is feasible, if you can do it. Can the star cluster go into core collapse before it reaches the galactic center? Will it make a collision runaway? Will it make an intermediate mass black hole and deposit that black hole into the galactic center? So we just want to test that hypothesis. So you see here the orbit of the star cluster. The bullet here indicates that it has 100,000 years. It took 100,000 years to go from here to there. It took another 100,000 years to go to here. Another 100,000 years to go to here. So the cluster is now in core collapse. And the initial relaxation time is about 10 million years or so. So here the cluster goes into core collapse. The half-mass radius starts expanding. The cluster loses mass due to the strong tidal field of the galaxy, evaporating very rapidly. So the dotted line here is the orbit of the cluster if it would not lose any mass. So if you have a black hole, basically, with the same mass of the cluster spiraling into the galactic center by dynamical friction, but the cluster remains behind a bit, it lags behind a little bit because it loses mass, so you see it goes in a little bit slower. And finally, it ends up into the galactic center, and it falls apart, and it deposits its nice object in the center, and the bright stars. Here you see the orbits of the number of orbits of the cluster as a function of the distance where it started off and normalized to 1. You see here the theoretical curve, and you see here the orbit of one of our model clusters. And it is so shaky, not because of the error bar, but because it picks up a very little bit of eccentricity on its way in. And finally, it dissolves. This one dissolves at the distance of about a parsec or so from the galactic center. Basically, to illustrate you how this thing operates. Well, let me show you a more rendered picture. What you see here, the picture here is black, so the black hole you won't see. This is the black hole in the center of the galaxy. The stars which make out the galactic center here we have brushed away, otherwise you wouldn't see the star cluster, which is this ball of purple stars. This star cluster was born at a distance of 8 parsec from the galactic center. And these are some background objects you shouldn't care about. At the end, the picture looked like this. So this cluster does not make it to the galactic center. It dissolves at some distance from the galactic center still, quite far away actually. But it had gone through core collapse, and it had made all the massive stars are still in the center of this star cluster. So all these tails here, you see all these tidal tails of the star cluster itself, are basically the low mass stars which are evaporated from the cluster. And I should show you this. I do the trick again. The problem is these view things is they can't really stream these things very well, so you have to do that separately. So this is an embodied simulation of this star cluster. Here it started, it orbits around the galactic center. It's completely, well, how does the observers know to call that? I mean, it's overexposed. So all the stars overlap each other, so you don't really see it very well. You see here how the star cluster starts losing mass and making tails. I don't think you can see that very well as being blue on black, but I hope it illustrates a little bit what it's doing. So you see the streaming of the stars through the first Lagrangian point into this leading tail and into the trailing tail, and slowly the star cluster will move inwards, and at the same time, It will go into core collapse. You get runaway collision in this particular case. In this particular case, we got about 10 collisions, stars smashing into each other, making something like a 200 solar mass object. And at the end, the massive stars which have been sunken into the center of the star cluster, which did not participate into the collision runaway, are deposited very close to the central star cluster. Maybe I can tell you now also, we have some time since the movie is running anyway, this graphical tool was programmed by Stuart Levy, and we used that, we coupled it onto the StarLab software, and now we can do very nice 3D renderation of these animations. So the data set for this kind of models are completely available. If you want to study these tidal tails, you're more than welcome to do that. Don't ask any questions about it.
Tail structure rather than it becoming filled in?
Yeah, you get these tails. Yeah, because the star cluster is not so very wide and it spirals in quicker than that it evaporates. So you get these tails very typically. I said no questions about the tails, right? So this was a model with 64,000 stars, and of course it was run on our nice great machine. So finally you get very nice structure here, yeah, I agree. Beautiful.
Well, now, will all these stars be captured by the black hole in the sense that they will be tidally disrupted? The individual?
Oh no. These stars, once they're out of the cluster, they are not affected anymore by dynamical friction. So they don't feel the wake, basically, at their back. There is no dynamical friction once they're out of the cluster. Only the stars in the cluster, as a bound entity, will feel any dynamical friction. And the black hole, which is made in the star cluster, needs the star cluster in order to become closer to the galactic center. Once the star cluster is gone, the black hole will just orbit the other black hole, which is in the center, and there will be hardly any dynamical friction anymore. So you need the star cluster.
But this star cluster now will be a disk around the galactic center?
Yeah, it will be kind of a torus or well, something. Yes. Yes, that's right. Let me go back to this. Somebody should teach me how to swap to one last picture in one blow, but I can't click on the slide, it doesn't work that way. Wish you did. Well, you can see everything again, that's nice, isn't it? All right, well, the controversy. This is the result of iron body models. This is the mass of the star cluster in logarithmic units. So this is 10,000 stars, a million stars, solar masses. And this is the mass of the most massive object we make in our models. Well, we can study this very small part of parameter space. We can do up to about 100,000 stars and study how collision runaway builds something like 1,000 solar mass object in a 100,000 star cluster. Of course, there is the detection of M82 mass, which is between a million solar mass and a few hundred solar mass, so it nicely fits in. And then I basically stopped drawing this line. You know, you should forget the rest of this picture. I didn't plot that on purpose, of course. So the mass of the remnant is something like a seed mass, which is generally the most massive star in the star cluster, times or plus some constant times the mass of the cluster. And this is about 10 minus 0.1% or so, 0.005%, 0.5. Well, a small fraction. What is the fraction again? So this is the idea. So what happens? It's a very complicated picture, but it's very nice because it's the same process happening on two different time scales, excuse me, and two different size scales. So what happens? We make a star cluster. The stars are born in a cluster. The cluster goes into core collapse. The massive star collides and makes a collision runaway. A blue-blue straggler is formed, finally collapsing into a supernova, makes an intermediate mass black hole, cluster dissolves. At the same time, the cluster is born near the galactic center. Well, if it is born near the galactic center. The dynamical friction drives it to the galactic center. In the meantime, the cluster makes its intermediate mass black hole. The black hole is carried by the star cluster to the galactic center. In the galactic center, this cluster dissolves. The black hole is deposited. These clusters, we see two of these clusters, which are both like 3 million years old. The estimate is that about every million years, there is a cluster like this falling into the galactic center and dissolving by the tidal field of the galaxy, depositing an intermediate mass black holes. So finally, what could happen is that these intermediate mass black holes smash into each other, making something that is more massive than what we basically have to start with. So that's my talk. Thank you. And 5 minutes early. No.
5 minutes early.
Yes.
All right, so plenty of time for questions. Now, I know you put primordial binaries in at least one of the simulations because you showed that that one was a little bit different. So wondering, were primordial binaries in these simulations that you just showed us?
Most of these simulations were done without primordial binaries. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could comment a little on the difference that that makes, just because as far as we know, most systems are actually made in binaries. Now, of course, within the forming globular cluster environment, it's conceivable that things are different. But, you know, sort of the simplest assumption would be that there are binaries there. So I wonder if you could talk about how that would influence your results.
Well, we didn't do the simulation with many primordial binaries. The idea is that if you put in primordial binaries, I don't think that result will be that different, because the whole collision runway is due to binaries. So what happens is the most massive stars go into the center of the cluster and they form a binary, and then another star smashes into it, and it's the bigger cross-section of the binary and the perturbation in the binary itself which drives the collision runaway in this case. So if you have many binaries around, you just have more degrees of freedom, and I don't really think that it makes a qualitative difference in what really happens.
Well, one of the things, I know you didn't put this in as an assumption because you were actually following this through, is, you know, if you did have a binary, a larger number of primordial binaries in the center, certainly both the geometrical and also gravitational cross-section would be larger for these things. And so it might be, you know, more competitive between the most massive object, most massive single object, and groups of binaries, which together, you know, maybe only each one separately might only be a few times less massive than the one massive star. So just, and those processes would tend to throw things out from the center rather than to have this core collapse proceed. So I was wondering if, in fact, it might not make some difference to have them there.
I think there are, you can, with primordial binaries, you can argue two ways. You can argue in the way that it becomes easier to make a collision runaway because the binaries have bigger cross sections and they're more massive. And there are arguments to argue against it because you have more degrees of freedom. And it's not really clear before we did the simulation to do any qualitative statements about it, I think. Yeah, we simply have to do the work. Most definitely.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about an additional effect. The runaway of your most massive star happens on a very short time scale, the order of a few million years. So it's of interest to ask what else could be happening in the cluster on that sort of time scale. Now, if you think about the protocluster cloud, that would have a dynamical time scale of a million or a few million years. And so that would be the time scale on which you could actually, or a lower limit to the time scale on which you could actually synchronize the star formation within the cluster. So I guess my question would be, you know, if you, now that these timescales have become so short, shouldn't we be thinking about the finite spread in the ages of the stars? For example, if the most massive stars went supernova before the rest of the stars even formed, then this picture would be changed, I would assume, radically.
Well, of course, I can't say that the simulations are very simple, but they're at least too simple for this kind of thing. So you don't take into account star formation, so all stars have the same age. If indeed the stars, for example, would have a different age, and the most massive star is much younger than older than the other stars, and in the center of the star cluster, then you can dramatically change the picture by.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering about the inevitability of the buildup of the 100 solar mass object, whether that would really happen if you imagine embedding this in a sort of a forming star cluster rather than an already perfectly formed stellar dynamical system.
Brad, is that a
thing? Actually, can I, since we're
this between us. To answer again Mike's point, in fact, this you could argue exactly the other way and say that if you have this spread in ages or star formation times, you actually need the most massive stars that formed first to conveniently go into this runaway and kind of disappear to prevent them from going supernova and blowing all the gas away before they have formed their lower mass stars, because otherwise you fail to form a star cluster.
Yeah.
Sure. But these are the kinds of problems you face anyway in the context of star cluster formation. They're not more important because of this process. True.
Yeah. But this effect, what Fred points to, this is exactly what we see also. I mean, you delay the first supernova, and therefore you can continue the collision runway longer than you would if you don't have any collisions.
To add in defense of your work that used only single stars to answer Roseanne's question, remember what Melvin showed the other day. He showed that in a binary single interaction, the probability of having a physical collision is quite high, like maybe 1 in 3. If all the massive stars were in binaries, which is quite likely, because in fact when we measure binary fractions for massive stars, they seem to be 100%. If all the massive stars are in binaries, then you're talking about all binary-binary interactions. And in a binary-binary interaction, the probability of having a physical collision between two of the four stars is essentially 100%. So then you just make the collision cross-section bigger.
Is that published, Fred?
I guess my question is on a related topic, which is if, for instance, by calculating white dwarfs, I can demonstrate that there's a very flat mass function, so that if you extrapolated that into the supernova range, you'd get so many supernovae that you'd unbind the cluster. I mean, would you basically then predict you'd have to go into this runaway and you'd have to have a 1,000 solar mass black hole in that cluster?
I don't understand the question.
Sorry?
Can you repeat the question? What is the question?
If you had a very flat mass function,
yes,
at the high end, so that you predict so many supernovae that you unbind the cluster, it seems pretty much inevitable that the only way out is your runaway. So that basically a flat mass function essentially predicts a 1,000 solar mass black hole in your center.
Well, you don't prevent this, first of all, with a flat mass function, so that is good. But I don't see, well, you still have a lot of supernovae if you have a flat mass function. You don't get all the stars in a single object. You always remain with a number of stars, so the details depend.
So there is a range of mass functions for which?
Yeah, well, we studied a range of mass functions, but we didn't go too extreme, because you have two things. You have the relaxation time of the cluster, and you have the mass function in that case. So it's a two-parameter problem. That is probably an area of parameter space where your story is true, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, what I didn't gather, I think, completely at the end is, are you trying to build up the supermassive black holes predominantly through this process? Because if you do, I think there's a constraint that we know that, for example, if you integrate quasar light, that more or less gives you all the mass that's in the quasars, in the supermassive black holes. So, and I think this way you would not be producing luminosity through accretion.
Right.
So
yeah.
If you want to build them up this way, I think you have a problem. Is it meant to be a significant contributor or just a small?
Well, the idea is that in this way you can go to about 1 million solar masses. You can't go very much further, because you also have your time problem. You have to do it early enough in the universe. And once your central black hole is about 1 million or so, then 1,000 solar mass objects putting into it is not really paying off anymore. It takes 1 billion years to make 1 million solar mass object.
Yeah.
So you can't really grow more than that in a reasonable amount of time. So I don't think you make the supermassive black holes this way. It's just intriguing that this curve all ends up in this upper right corner. I don't particularly believe it, let's put it that way.
Simon, did you follow the simulations after the formation of the intermediate mass black hole? What I'm wondering about is what is going to happen to that black hole if the cluster doesn't go close to a supermassive black hole, so it's still isolated.
Yeah.
Is there any possibility that it would acquire a binary companion?
It will, yes.
You would expect
it. It's inevitable,
that?
Yeah. You will definitely...
With
you,
the
you
most
can't get
massive
rid of the black
star
hole.
Around after...
Yeah.
Okay.
Typically it will have... a little cluster of stars around it, bound, so you get a very complicated high-order system, and it's conceivable that something smashes into it once in a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is related to the question Andrew asked. What would you expect for the spin of the initial supermassive black hole to be in a scenario like this? Would it be different in the spirals and the ellipticals, because in the spirals, you expect all of the black holes spiraling in to be in the same plane?
No. First of all, they don't spiral into the same plane, because the bulge is symmetric, is spherical. So there is, you don't see anything of the disk here. It all happens very deep into the bulge. The other question about the rotation of the black hole, that also has to do with relativity and things like that. I mean, the black hole itself, when it is growing, there are other black holes punning into it. So to make the intermediate mass, or the supermassive black hole, basically. So you have black hole collisions with black holes. One, and the central black hole we call more and more massive, so the amount of angular momentum you put into it is less and less. So I'm not really sure that what the final angular momentum will be of the massive object. I don't think it's necessarily extremely high, actually, for several reasons.
Well, my question is not on the black hole. But you have stellar evolution in your calculations, don't you? So
yes.
We will also have lots of collisions with giants and...
No.
So you don't?
No. All collisions happen with the same single object. So there is the single object. Once it's more massive than anything else, it's a designated target for the next collision.
Well, I'm not just talking about the center, I mean the whole cluster.
There's only collisions in the center of the cluster. No, there are no other collisions. There are only collisions with the central object.
Right. My question was whether there are any other interesting objects you form, but I guess you don't form any.
The answer is no.
I'm slightly puzzled by that, but okay.
Well, we were puzzled by it at first also, but I think...
Just to make the point there, people are worried. I mean, I think what Simon does, he runs his code, and if the stars get close, and they hit, right? So he sees what hits. He's not assuming that what hits. He finds what hits. But the point with the red giants aren't hit that often, because even though they're big, they're not big for very long.
This is also very
young. Point here also, yeah, okay.
Well, if you continue it longer, if the black hole is still there, then you can have collisions with giants in the black hole.
So, I mean, if you have a somewhat different initial condition, then...
No, you don't get a collision runaway. Yeah. Okay. There are loads of interesting objects, Philippe. I mean, really.
I just want to ask a little bit about how you did handle stellar evolution. For these very massive stars, there's two problems. One is it's not even clear they're bound objects. I'm going to give you that they are bound, otherwise you're in big trouble. But the real question is their luminosity approaches basically the Eddington luminosity. So there's a characteristic time scale for massive stars, which is basically the mass of the object times the nuclear energy per gram divided by the Eddington luminosity. For these stars, that's a few million years. So it's burning up itself in a few million years. It seems to me you have to have the time scale be much shorter than that to even have the growth of the object occur faster than the rate at which it's evolving and becoming a supernova. So it looks like to me that the real constraint is that the collision time and all the time scales be less than a few million years, not 30 million years. Can you just comment on whether that's reasonable? I mean, that's...
You're completely
right.
It seems
like there's very fine tuning you have to get to get that time scale short.
No, you're completely right. The 30 million years is the relaxation time of the cluster. The 3 million years is really the lifetime of these massive stars.
Right.
So you have to do this whole business in 3 million years. Otherwise, it's game over.
Okay, so that sort of fundamental nuclear time scale is coming in.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
And that's why you've got roughly that simulation you've got is exactly 3 million years.
That's right.
But
everything shorter will do.
Yeah.
So 3 million years is kind of the upper limit. And
right,
Mark will say more about that.
Stars don't exist, but that's separate.
Well, that's a separate issue. Yeah.
Simon, what remains from this dissolved cluster can contribute to a transient AGN activity? For the central black hole?
You mean the cluster, the stars in the cluster smashing into the central black hole?
Yes, or the gaseous component due to...
Once the cluster is dissolved, it will become part of the bulge, basically. And the bulge stars will do their own thing. So, yes, it's conceivable that once in a while a star smashes into the central black hole in the galaxy. I think Mark will say more about that. So I defer this question to his talk in that case, I guess.
Just to return to the binaries, what are the prospects for putting them in? Because it's surely going to change things enormously. And the second question is, can you comment in light of what you've been showing us here on the question I was asking Eric, I think after his talk, for the intermediate mass binaries or moderately massive binaries in a globular cluster to solve the neutron star problem, and the comment I made then that these will undoubtedly undergo core collapse, and have self-destruction, if you like, built in. So in this context, we've got even more massive stars and massive binaries once you put them in, isn't it going to be a similar problem? You're going to have a very different outcome.
Which question do you want me to answer first? Well, it's not really clear what is the question.
The question is, let's go back to the first question. What are the prospects for putting binaries into this?
It's running.
Okay. But then the second question is, if you have them, would you not expect them to cause core collapse in this cluster and change everything?
I don't think that it will be that different. I think the number of interesting objects, the number of collisions you make outside the building up a central massive object, so Philippe's question basically will become more important. So you get collisions outside the thing, but that's just the binary evolution basically what plays a role there. Apart from the fact the calculation will become considerably more complicated. And your question to neutron stars, that's a completely different question, I think, isn't it? That the question was, how do you get neutron stars in globular clusters and prevent them from kicking each other out or so, or?
Yeah, the question was, if you have binaries as the saviors, which they must be to keep the neutron stars in the clusters, and in the primordial cluster, this massive binary population will sink, be dynamically unstable, the cluster will go into some sort of core collapse, fault itself by those very binaries breaking them all up.
Yeah, it's a completely different regime in parameter space here, where you're talking about. So a global cluster has an initial relaxation time of about 1 billion years or so, and we are talking about 10 million years as initial relaxation time. So there's several orders of magnitude difference here. But so global clusters do something different. But I think we can talk about this, but not in context of this thing.
Follow-up on Andrea's question about the effect of, you know, if you forget about the black hole that you're forming in the cluster, just the process of having the cluster spiral into the more massive black hole that's already at the center, if indeed it is already there, could itself have some very interesting consequences. And he mentioned the radiation you might get as things accrete onto this object. But I was also, there's a second interesting effect that's often overlooked, which is that if you would have something like a ring of stars around the black hole, a disk, or even if stars just are populating this area and one of them occasionally passes close enough to the black hole, there will be tidal stripping. And if this is particularly interesting if the star that's stripped is a giant, because then what's left is the core of the star, which can burn as a very soft X-ray source for periods between 1,000 and 1,000,000 years, depending on what the giant was and what its status was at the time it was stripped. So if, in fact, just from looking at the Milky Way and other galaxy centers, there are enough clusters that this rate of clusters falling into the center and disrupting as you've modeled them, if this is something where, say, within 10 megaparsecs, there might have been one of these events within the past 100,000 years, there might be some interesting signature of the event in the form of soft X-ray sources near the center of the galaxy.
Well, they are observed in the galactic center, these type of sources. And
you can't really observe them because they're too soft in X-rays.
The source is called IRIS 16, which is a cluster of stars.
Oh, I see, the cluster, yes.
And it's not a cluster. It is a kind of stream of stars, which has velocity characteristics and spatial characteristics very similar to what we simulate. Whether or not these stars will finally enter, so these are very young stars. These are 20 solar masses or more massive stars at a distance of less than 0.4 parsec from the galactic center, from the central black hole. Mm-hmm. Whether or not these stars will finally interact with the black hole or not, these probably don't, because they don't live long enough in order to have interactions. Mm-hmm. But if you have a population of all the stars which are leftovers from this type of clusters, then they may, and you can possibly see them.
But you had a rate that you built into your code, though, didn't you?
I didn't build anything in. It's just Newton.
No, in terms of mentioning how frequently, based on the data, like the one you just mentioned, how frequently you expect this type of process to happen.
Well, we don't model the collisions with the central black hole in the galactic center here.
All right, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut this off. Got to give the other speakers time to speak. Thanks
all right.
Again. And